The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Well, it's his first book. It's called A Flower Shop in Baghdad. Michael Banzett, he's in the house right now. Michael, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mark.
Michael, on the very page, you know, the cover of this book, we see a soldier here, and it looks like he's almost out in the desert. Can you kind of explain the cover of this book?
Well, that is exactly right. It's an airman. It's me standing out in the middle of the desert. It's the title is a bit of a disconnect from what you see on there. But the point of the book, which you're going to have to wait for until the last chapter, I do kind of wrap it up. It's there I was standing in the middle of the desert, and the impact that we've had on the Iraqis and the Iraqis had on me, quite frankly, is that's to get your attention and say, why is this guy talking about a flower shop? Clearly, there's no flowers anywhere in the vicinity there.
Well, this book, A Flower Shop in Baghdad, takes place from the very beginning when you enlist in the Air Force, and it goes clear through, what, your career?
Right, right. The only time I wanted to talk about me, the only reason I wanted to talk about me, I'm just a regular guy. I really felt that we needed to understand how special this country is, and what a regular person is here is viewed differently elsewhere, and especially throughout my career. I was just a high school graduate. I knew I'd always wanted to be in the Air Force. I really did. I spend a few pages explaining why airplanes are different for me. But, you know, I was just a regular guy. So I had to talk about why what we thought was ordinary here is so extraordinary elsewhere. And I felt I had to tell that story in order to tell the other story. So not only is this place amazing and spectacular, but the stuff that you didn't read about that happened in Iraq, I really can't speak for Afghanistan, but I bet it's much the same. We certainly hear all the bad things. Abu Ghraib is on everyone's lips. I don't have to explain that to anybody. But the way the Iraqis interacted with us and we with them, and I really only kind of talk about it from my perspective because I only wrote about what I saw and did, but the interactions that I had showed me, there's a few chapters that talk about that explicitly, that other people were doing the same thing. The way they reacted to me, an American they didn't know, and the interactions they'd had with other Americans led them to trust me, even though they didn't know me. They trusted me and our guys more than they trusted the other Iraqis. And that was, to me, that was significant.
Flower Shop in Baghdad, pretty much the view of one soldier, the view through his eyes of people, not only maybe in this country, but around the world?
Correct. Oh, yeah. We had, I mean, I always get a bit of a chuckle when I hear, you know, how that was a unilateral effort or this thing. The other thing, I was surrounded by other militaries. I worked for a Brit, and there's some funny stories in there, and they're amazing. I mean, there were folks in there from just about everywhere, you know, Japan and Germany, and I kept running Aussies and Tongans, believe it or not. I was like, and they're all huge, by the way. I don't know. They are amazing people. And you sit there and you look around, you're surrounded by folks that are different militaries all trying to lend a hand. So no, we weren't there by ourselves for sure. And there were civilians there, you know, the military folks. A lot of people were there trying to help these folks, give them a hand up because they were so utterly broken. And that was another aspect of it I try to bring out in the book is that you and I just take, you know, if you or I call 911, I have zero fear about that. I expect somebody to show up and try and help me. And it wasn't like that. And it started me thinking, what happens in a society where you don't trust somebody you haven't known for a long time? So you cannot call 911 because the guy that shows up may either shake you down at the very least or report you to the bad guys or kill you himself. So the trust that they had none of, and again, the two guys, there's two guys that I talk about, and they knew each other since they were three or four. And I talk about, they trusted each other, obviously, but Saddam had made it so no one else could trust anyone else. And how that manifests itself in running a military or running a government or any of that kind of stuff.
Well, you were there right after the fall of Hussein.
Well, was it 2007? I went there, so it was a few years. You know, a couple of years during the hard combat was kind of over. We certainly got rocketed, and again, I wasn't in the kicking down door aspect of it. We were very, very different. You know, the Army and the Marines were still very busy and in a lot of danger. But no, I was more of I was embedded with CAFT, the Coalition Air Force Training Team, or Transition Team, depending on where you went. And that was purely to get the Iraqi Air Force in particular, stood up so that they could operate on their own. And so it was a dangerous period for them as well, because the organized resistance had kind of fallen off, but the unorganized, other than Al-Qaeda and some of those other groups, had kind of risen up to take the organized resistance place. And that's another point of another aspect of this. They were in a tremendous amount of danger. When I went to bed at night, I had, you know, the Army and the Marines, all those good guys protecting me. You know, oftentimes they would have to spend the night out in the town, with their families and stuff like that, where they were very vulnerable. And the young guys, the first class of Iraqi cadets, I talk about some of the steps they had to take. And that brings up something I did want to emphasize, that the names in these books for the Iraqis, I've changed them all. Because I didn't really get the permission. I don't think they would mind, but I'm not going to ask. I'm not going to. I still have email communications with a couple of them, and I don't want them to even say, yeah, I'll do it. They're far too valuable.
It seems like before we went in to defeat Hussein, you had kind of a balance of power with the Iranians and the Iraqis. And that's kind of change now. What's your feeling on that, and what is the feeling of the people maybe of Iraq?
Well, right, yeah, exactly. Right now they're at kind of a weak point. I did ask some of the folks. I said, "What is because we had evidence in many cases that the Iranians were either helping covertly or overtly in some cases. There was a couple places where we thought that their CUD organization was very involved. The Iranians and the Iraqis had been at war." I can't remember how long that war took, the Iran-Iraq war, but cost them millions of people. And I asked him, I said, what is the beef here? What's the problem? And I call him Colonel Wahid in here. He just turns and goes, Iran just wants to watch us burn. And, you know, this is a conflict. Iranians don't consider themselves Arabs. They consider themselves Persians. And they consider the Iraqis Arabs. And you know, if two people want to fight, they'll figure out a reason. So I think Saddam Hussein had to have, a lot of dictators have to have an external enemy. You know, he'd pick a fight with whoever he could so that they could be focused on that versus the fact that he was a terrible, terrible, tyrannical dictator. So I think that there's several things holding the Iranians in check now. They are kind of surrounded by world opinion that is looking at them very, very carefully for their nuclear efforts, I think. And I don't believe that Iraq would be a pushover right now anyway. I think we've done a pretty darn good job of standing up the right kind of folks. So I think they're safe for now. And hopefully I just can't wait for you to finish it, because the people that I'm talking about there, I guarantee we'll be seeing them in positions of power in 15 or 20 years. At least I hope we do.
So when I get a flower shop in Baghdad, your brand new book, what do you as the author expect the reader to take from this book?
Well, a couple of things. One is a profound appreciation for where you live. I mean, unless you live somewhere else, then you know.
Like my house.
I guess, yeah. Yeah, the United States, I feel, is when you leave the borders of this country, you just left the best place on earth. And there may be a contest with a couple of countries, but not for the rest of the world. The rest of the world looks upon us for guidance, whether they admit to it or not. They looked upon us for even an example. That sounds kind of corny, but I believe it. So it's an appreciation for where you live and the things that you've got and how free we really are. And then the second part of that is what our military does on a daily basis that you do not hear about. The millions of interactions they have with local people. Even in combat, we are very, very concerned about hurting civilians and things like that. And if we do hurt civilians, it's a mistake. It's not a practice. Our guys will go out of their way to save civilians from bad guys who have put them in danger. I would like to get not only a profound appreciation for where we live now, but a realization of the good things that the military does every single day, whether it's in combat or not. Your military is such a good example of who we are out in the field. And I guess that's a long, rambling answer to a kind of a short answer, I suppose.
So were we spreading ourselves too thin across the world? Because we are pretty much known as the policemen of the world.
We are. Well, it depends on the situation. Depends on the mission. There's types of missions that are really just being a good example, or being, like I said, a moral authority kind of figure, where you don't have to have divisions and squadrons. In our case, obviously, if you're in combat, you want the maximum amount of people. You want to apply. You want it to make it as quick and violent as you possibly can, so it ends quickly, saving lives. So if you pick and choose where you get engaged in combat, that's a very different proposition than having a lot of people go a lot of places and just be, provide guidance or indigenous support or something like that. If you're careful, no. But the DOD is wrestling with significant cuts right now. So that means if we're going to cut those kinds of things, then we have to be careful about where we send our folks. The worst part is if you send somebody undermanned, under-equipped out into combat. That's the worst part.
A lot of people may be libertarians. Mm-hmm. I tend to even lean that way mm-hmm. myself. Say that we should maybe stay out of other countries. Your feeling on that from a retired, even officer?
Mm-hmm. I tell you what, I kind of lean libertarian myself. I would like to stay out of other people's affairs to the maximum extent. But to me, it's kind of like living in a homeowners association, which I unfortunately live in. It's kind of a pain in the butt for me, right? Once in a while, if I have a dandelion, I can't put a trailer in my house, because why? Well, it brings down the property value of everyone's home if I, start raising pigs in my backyard or something. And it's kind of that same thing. If we had spent some time and effort, and I don't think it has to be expensive necessarily, but to mentor some countries, maybe we wouldn't have had to fight them later. It's as long as you're not going to hurt me, I really shouldn't care about you. But it's hard to see suffering and not do anything about it. We're I don't know if it's good or bad. You see suffering in African countries and you want to go help. And that costs a lot of money. And especially when you deploy the military to do it, that's probably the least cost-effective way to do it, because, there's a lot of gear that goes with them. So it's a constant wrestling match. I know that I'm not a big fan of nation building, unless, of course, I don't think you can make the argument that we didn't build Germany and Japan and had a part in reconstructing Italy and those kinds of places. And I think that turned out pretty darn good. Again, it's picking your battles. You can't do it everywhere, no matter how much the need is out there. And it is. If most countries were more like the United States, I think more people would be healthier. Well, probably fatter. A lot of people in the world would love to be fat. They really would.
Michael, your brand new book, it's hilarious. It is a page turner. Why the book? Why did you just say, gosh, I think I'm going to write? What possessed you to become an author?
Well, I think I told you out in the hall, I feel like I had the cure for cancer, and I couldn't get anybody to listen to me. If you come in my house, I can certainly bend your ear for a long time about that, but not enough people, and I don't think my wife would want me to have everybody in the universe come to my house. But again, it was like something, there was a story that needed to be told. I didn't see being told anywhere else. As a matter of fact, about my mid-tour, I wrote an article that was picked up by my hometown newspaper that said, "When is Iraq newsworthy? I'm seeing all these cool things happening here." As a matter of fact, an older gentleman, I forget his name in the book, darn it. Well, actually, I know his real name, but I don't remember what I called him there, so I can't say it. But he was in charge of one of the divisions over there, really kind of an old grandpa. He was a grandfather. And he had made the determination that Baghdad was now safe enough to bring his daughter and his grandchildren back into the city. And at the same time, I was seeing, hometown, or not hometown, but back in the States and elsewhere, how dangerous Baghdad still was and how awful it was. And it was terrible, terrible. And I said, what kind of calculation did that grandfather make before he said, honey, come on back, bring your family back, it's safe enough for you? And so there was a bunch of that kind of disconnect. I have this feeling that if the news is filtered and biased, and people bring their biases to the table for sure, I certainly do, the people who react to that by either voting or whatever don't have the whole story. There's good, there's certainly a lot of good, there was bad too. Abu Ghraib was probably not the only bad thing that happened, but the good wasn't talked about nearly enough. There were some significant events that happened over there that people are not aware of. So I wasn't an author. I went to my hometown in Kalispell, Montana to do a book signing there. And I said, no one would be more surprised than my English teachers that I actually, knew a lot of words and stuck them in some sort of order on a written page. And I actually taught a class about why English is important. And why it's important is because I never, ever dreamed I would write a book. I just wanted to fly airplanes ever since I was a little guy. And so I did that. And then guess what? I ended up writing a book about some flying, not a whole lot of airplane flying happens in there. It was, I needed to tell that story. And I looked around the room and it was just me in there. So I started banging away on the computer.
So, you know, you can fly airplanes and you're really good at it. How about paper airplanes? I've never been good at that.
Again, those same English teachers probably would have made the case that that's what they expected me to do, because I have been accused of launching several things in classes.
Michael, you know, you brought up a question for me when you were just talking about the book. Is, of course, everybody's name has been changed in this,
right?
Especially the Iraqis. How did you keep everything straight as you go through the book with not getting their name and remembering who their name was?
Oh, I had a Rosetta Stone for myself. I wrote down this guy equals this guy, because you're right. Okay, who's this guy again? I don't even know who it is. And the other thing, I did get a professional editor. I'm sure there's going to be a couple of diction errors or something in there. I say it lends authenticity. But I did pay to have an editor do it, and he helped because... And I kind of explained this in the book. I went through a couple of different methods to write it. The first part was chronological because that was easy to do. It was, you know, me getting doing this, and this. But then when I got into the Iraqi portion, and as I explained there, I kind of had to, all the stories kind of ended at the same time, so I couldn't tell them sequentially. So they were all blending. It was kind of like a rope, you know, everything lended support to the other story. So I couldn't tell it chronologically anymore. And that got confusing because I would write about an event. And then I would say, you know, this is the first time I boarded a helicopter, but I had said that before. And so I did have an editor help me with that, trying to put, you know, things proper in sequence. When I said, this is the first time I jumped on a helicopter, it was. And so, that helped out a bunch.
So intertwining those stories, that was pretty much maybe the biggest challenge, or was it?
No, it wasn't a challenge, because to me it happened that way. You know, it was chronological, but the points I was trying to make with the different stories, I did have to kind of separate that out. But that's how it happened to me, so it was kind of easy to write that way. But when I was remembering those stories and looking at, I had taken a few notes, you know, just in my daily logbook, I would, you know, write stuff that I wanted to do during that day and stuff that we got accomplished and all those kinds of things. So I'd look at that and I'd say, oh yeah, I did that and we did this. And I bounced it off a couple of folks that were there with me to make sure I didn't make any egregious errors. And it was really rewarding, the things that they said back. You know, that was really cool to see. So it was a joy. It actually was a joy to write. I mean, the physical stuff about it, what really prompted me to finish it was, I told somebody within hearing of my wife, unfortunately, I said, yeah, I'm writing a book. And she goes, no, you're not. I was like, oh, all right. I got to finish this thing up. But it was an absolute joy to write. I'm surprised at how it turned out. I didn't realize that I could do that.
So first-time writer, how long did it take to write A Flower Shop in Baghdad?
Probably a good 2 years. I mean, again, it was a spurt of about, you know, 6 or 8 months, and then a few words here and there, and then my wife yelled at me, and then I finished it up again. So, and that was a challenge, because I really did have to make sure that I remembered things right, and so I would, you know, send out notes to folks that I knew and say, hey, does this write? And even in the first edition, this is the second edition of this, one of the folks that was over there said, I got your book, I loved it, but you forgot about this and made this part of the story. I only changed, like, I think 2 sentences, but it's a critical 2 sentences, you know? And I said, oh, I forgot about that. You're right. So I changed it, and we sent out a second edition.
Michael, A Flower Shop in Baghdad, it sounds like the early years you were a family of nomads. Tell me a little about that.
What do you mean, my family? Oh, yeah. Well, I loved where I grew up. I grew up in a little town called Marysville, Montana, and it was an old ghost town. It really was. It was great. You know, I don't know how many kids my mom and dad started off with. It was kind of like this big Darwin experiment that sent us out into the woods and whoever showed up for dinner that night. But it was awesome. It was an old mining town that had at one point like 3,000 or 4,000 people in it, and then the gold left and everybody left. And there was probably 50 people in it, but it looked like an old Clint Eastwood set. It was beautiful. Then we moved a little closer to town. By that, we used to have to drive 7 miles to the bus stop, which then took us like 20 miles into school. So we moved closer like 7 miles. So I only had to take the bus in. I loved it. I really do. I love the country. I love that part of the world. And then I joined the Air Force, and my first duty station was Spain. So here's this young, you know, Montana kid in Spain. And I loved that too. Again, it was, I talk about that in the book a little bit, that they counted on us. Even the Spanish were very sophisticated and very culturally advanced and all that kind of stuff, kind of counted on us to show them the way. And, you know, they were flying F-18s, and it was a great experience. I was welcomed with open arms in the little village. I lived in a little village called Montsalbarba. They couldn't have been nicer. They just couldn't have been. So I enjoyed being out in the country. We have a little bit of land in Montana, and kind of like the Air Force, I bought the land with a runway, no house, no golf course, no nothing. So I'll put in a golf course and then buy a plane and then put a house on it.
Well, Montana gets pretty cold, and if you were walking 7 miles to the bus stop and it was probably all uphill there and back.
Yeah, naked in a snowstorm. Exactly. Yeah, when the story gets told to the kids, that's exactly how it works. No, but that's where I learned to drive. Mom would stick me on her lap and we'd drive 7 miles. I was probably 6 or 7 or whatever. And away we'd go and jump on the bus stop. My brother and I, and my sister is about 4 or 5 years younger than us, so she didn't have to deal with that. But we had a ball. I mean, it was the best thing ever. We couldn't watch TV because it didn't come in, and you know, we could still, you know, it was radio and stuff like that. And it was just, you spend all your time out exploring and things like that. And that's what I want with my kids.
This book, your brand new book, funny, you've got stories in here and you almost twist them around, so it's almost like an air of comedy in a sense. Do you get that naturally, or do you put it on paper and you look at it and say, well, let's go this way with it? How do you do that?
I don't think I'm smart enough to do it on purpose. I just that's the way it falls out of my head. I don't know how far you got in it, but there are things that happen. And I guess my sense of humor has served me well. It really has. We've been in some pretty crappy situation. And having a sense of humor, well, it doesn't diminish the importance of what's going on around you. I mean, we were giggling in the middle of a mortar attack. You know, as long as you don't get hit, that's fine, I guess, as long as you take the appropriate actions. But it's a stress reliever. It's official. I was the class clown for, so this is not a new gift for me. I enjoyed the way it came out. I guess it was just natural. I guess the short answer to your question is it was just natural. I enjoyed writing it. And I still I don't know what that means about me, but I still, when I'm reading it to my wife or whatever, if she'll let me, we'll start giggling over this.
Yeah,
no kidding. Well, she's has never read the book from cover to cover, but she'll read some of it. And she was there for, you know, the generation of it. But when she sits there and reads, she'll start laughing, and you know, she was there. So that's a pretty good indicator of, I think people will genuinely enjoy it.
Well, I guess if you're being attacked by mortars or something, it's almost like maybe the police or maybe forensics. I mean, they have to make jokes of this or it might drive them insane.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that I have never had to deal, well, there's some stories in there that are not quite as happy, but I haven't really had to deal with the aftermath of that kind of stuff. But that, you know, I think that would be a real gift to be able to somehow offset all that pain and anguish and the darker side that you'd have to do. That would be, and I think a lot of the military folks have that, maybe have a reputation for being uncaring or the ability to make jokes, but I think that's where that's from. The military generally has to deal with some pretty dark things, and these are just regular folks, you know? So I think some of the Army, Marine humor is lost on some people, but those are good people, you know, dealing with some pretty terrible situations.
So do you have another book in you?
I might. People have asked about that. This one certainly drove me more than anything else, I think. If I do one now, it will be a slightly different reason, because maybe I think I have a story to tell. But this one drove me. There is more to that story for sure than what is in there. There's some people keep reminding me, you forgot about this. There's quite a bit more, and maybe I'll release a third edition with more of that stuff in there or something. I would like to take a crack at fiction. I would like to take a crack at humorous political stuff, because I think everybody is so eager to be offended about something nowadays that you almost have to approach it with humor. You can probably get away with more with humor. And I really enjoy P.J. O'Rourke's writing, because he gets you in the middle of laughing. You're like, oh, that is a good point. You know, and he can get you to think about stuff without being offended by it. So maybe something along those lines. I hope. I enjoyed it. I really did.
Michael, let's find out about more information about your brand new book, A Flower Shop in Baghdad. If I wanted to find out more about the book, about you, where to order it, where you're going to be, maybe if you're out on maybe a tour on a book signing, I'm sure you got a website.
We do a flower shop in Baghdad. It's not super good. I don't think my forte is website management, but it works. You can go to flowershopinbaghdad.com. I'm going to start a blog so we can interact a little more. It's on Amazon. It's on Kindle. I think I'm going to do an audiobook. I like to do that. You know, I figured if I wrote a fabulous book, people would come banging down the door to get it. It's just hard to get the word out there. So I appreciate this opportunity, Mark.
A Flower Shop in Baghdad by Michael Banzett. I tell you what, this book is a page-turner. It's laugh-out-loud funny. You're going to want more, and hey, like me, when you're finished with this book, A Flower Shop in Baghdad, you're going to hope that Michael is on his way to his next book. Michael, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you very much for the opportunity, Mark. Appreciate it.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.